This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. The White House is clarifying its position on Iran after President Joe Biden gave an interview in which he indicated that the United States would not lift sanctions until Tehran stops enriching uranium. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters Monday, quote, "Just to be very clear, the president never said that exactly." Biden, in a television interview aired Sunday, nodded when CBS anchor Nora O'Donnell asked about lifting sanctions and whether Iran must first halt enrichment of uranium at a higher level than allowed under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Agreement. The United States withdrew from the international agreement, often known as the Iran nuclear deal, under the Trump administration. The White House press secretary said Monday, "I think if we were announcing a major policy change, we would do it in a different way than a slight head nod." She said if Iran comes into full compliance with its obligations under the international agreement, the United States would do the same. She said Washington would then use that as a platform to build a larger and stronger agreement. State Department officials are echoing that message and emphasizing that they are discussing the issue with allies rather than seeking dialogue directly with Tehran. State Department spokesman Ned Price, also speaking Monday, told reporters, quote, "When it comes to getting engagement with the Iranians, we're not there yet. We want to again make sure that we have our ducks in a row with our closest friends, our closest partners and allies, as well," he added, "as with the U.S. Congress." The pact had allowed Iran to enrich uranium at a 3.67% concentration level, but since mid-2019, it had pushed enrichment to 20%, the level it had achieved before the accord. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. Myanmar's military declared a curfew Monday in the country's two most populous cities following days of large protests against the junta's seizure of power last week. Tens of thousands of people demonstrated across Myanmar for the third consecutive day Monday, exactly 1 week after the junta detained Aung San Suu Kyi and other leaders of the elected civilian government. The demonstrators held signs that read, "Save Myanmar, we want democracy." Some held just photos of Suu Kyi. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, the general who led the coup, made no mention of the unrest in his address to the nation Monday evening. It was his first since taking power. He reiterated claims that the November election was fraudulent, but he promised to hold new elections to bring a true and disciplined democracy, in his words, different from previous eras of military rule. The military announced an 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. curfew would be imposed in the cities of Yangon and Mandalay. The United Nations has called for the coup to be reversed, urging international actors to, quote, "carry out calls for a return to democracy." Reuters news agency is reporting that North Korea maintained and developed its nuclear and ballistic missile programs through 2020 in violation of international sanctions. Reuters said the information came from a confidential United Nations report examined by a reporter on Monday. The report by independent sanctions monitors said Pyongyang produced fissile material, maintained nuclear facilities, upgraded its ballistic missile infrastructure, and continued to seek material and technology for those programs from abroad. The annual report to the Security Council's North Korea Sanctions Committee comes just weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden took office. A State Department spokesman said Monday the administration planned a new approach to North Korea, including a full review with allies, quote, on ongoing pressure options and the potential for any future diplomacy. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump met three times in 2018 and 2019, but failed to make progress on U.S. calls for Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons and on North Korea's demands for an end to sanctions. Colombian President Iván Duque will give temporary protective legal status to Venezuelan migrants, according to a joint statement with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. The status will allow the migrants to work legally in Colombia. It's the top destination for people fleeing economic and social collapse in neighboring Venezuela. About 966,000 of the 1.73 million Venezuelan migrants living in Colombia do not currently have legal status. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. You're listening to VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's Prime Minister reshuffles his cabinet.
This cabinet is composed of several members who were suggested or proposed by the Forces of Freedom and Change and the partners in Juba Peace Accord.
Somalia's opposition says it will no longer recognize Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo as president. We'll have analysis from Mogadishu. And Liberia's Supreme Court upholds a corruption guilty verdict for a former defense minister.
The question is, with the Supreme Court upholding the lower court verdict that the minister must restitute the amount in question, is $1.4 million, or serve 2 years in prison, is very, very controversial.
And Burkina Faso has good practices for regulation on artisanal firearms. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok has reshuffled his cabinet. The new members include Jibril Ibrahim, the leader of a Darfur rebel group, the Justice and Equality Movement, as the new finance minister. The Sudanese government last October signed a peace deal with rebel groups. Prime Minister Hamdok also appointed Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi of the opposition Umar Party as the new foreign minister. Amjad Farik is the assistant chief of staff to Prime Minister Hamdok.
Today, the prime minister announced his second cabinet after the glorious revolution of December 2018. And it's composed of several members who were suggested or proposed by the Forces of Freedom and Change and the partners in Juba Peace Accord. And they represent the soul of the Sudanese political movement. This cabinet will be facing a lot of challenges, including the economic situation and the long heritage of 30 years of corruption and mismanagement during the NCP Islamist regime. The prime minister have selected them out of list of candidates that presented to him in order to ensure regional homogeneous implementation of the plan to rescue the country during the coming years from that heritage, reaching to a point of complete democratization of the country and implementation of a just and long-lasting peace in the country.
The appointment from the Justice and Equality Movement, what is behind that?
Justice and Equity Movement is a movement that fought against the previous regime with all of its injustice and racial discrimination in the country. And it's a movement that it's part of the revolutionary forces in the country and part of Juba Peace Accord. Justice and Equity Movement proposed names were selected within the mandate to bring the country to the previous era of racial discrimination and all the injustice that happened in the last 30 years. I think the prime minister is full aware that the price of peace is to accommodate all the Sudanese who worked hard, actually, for changing the previous regime that was built on radicalism and racial discrimination and injustice and inequality that was imposed with many factors that the Incas and NCP regime adopted. They are like the rest of the political movement that work together in forming the Forces of Freedom and Change and the Revolutionary Front and work to restore peace and stability in Sudan. What I actually question is the rationale behind this question. All the Sudanese who have actually a real stake in making change in Sudan are equally responsible and should work for implementing real change in Sudan, in which that we adopt the values of freedom, peace, and justice that our revolution have had as its slogans.
What can you tell us about the appointment of the new foreign minister, Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi? What does her appointment mean to the government?
Dr. Mariama Sadiq is one of the faces of the resistance during the last three decades against the previous regime. And I think she's very capable of representing the foreign policy of this country in the coming period. And again, it also ensures the representation of women and how the prime minister values that within his cabinet.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Amjad Farid is the Assistant Chief of Staff to Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The United Nations says it is pleased with the lifting of a blockade of key roads to Jenina, the regional capital of West Darfur. The UN says lifting the blockade, which lasted several weeks, will allow humanitarian organizations to scale up assistance to people displaced by recent violence in West Darfur. The UN says to date, over 67,000 internally displaced people who are in Jenina have received food for 1 month, as well as water, non-food items, and health services. Somalia's opposition has ceased to recognize President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo after his term ended at midnight Sunday with no election agreement. Farmajo addressed parliament on Monday in an attempt to end the political standoff. Mohamed Kaheya reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia's international partners, including the United States, have raised their concerns about the political impasse that has delayed the country's presidential and parliamentary elections. President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo's four-year term in office expired on Monday, February 8th, and the coalition of the opposition presidential candidates through their spokesman Ridwan Hersi said they will not recognize President Farmajo as the head of state.
Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo must respect the constitution and give up his responsibility as head of state. We call on all stakeholders or participants in the political process to build a transitional council that includes the president of the People's Assembly.
However, some lawmakers like Abdi Shire believe that Farmajo is still legally president until he's replaced or re-elected as per resolution approved by two houses of parliament last year. Shire says that the existing resolutions passed by the National Assembly say that if elections are not conducted in a stipulated time, all the constitutional office holders, including the president, will be in power until they are replaced through elections. Somalia was scheduled to hold indirect parliamentary elections late last year before presidential elections in February, but the process has been held up by disagreement between political stakeholders on who will serve on the commission overseeing the polls. Professor Afiere Elmi is Associate Professor of Security Studies at Qatar University. He says if both sides do not conduct themselves in a mature manner, there might be security setbacks in Somalia in coming weeks. On Sunday, 12 members of Somalia's security forces were killed in an explosion near the town of Dusamareb. Al-Shabaab claimed the responsibility for the attack.
The security implications could be problematic if there is no solution within the next maybe few weeks, because there is a polarization within the political class. And so for the last, 4 years, the president and his administration was not helpful in terms of managing the diversity of the Somali political groups.
President Farmajo made no comments on Monday, but on Saturday, he addressed the parliament saying his administration will try to implement September agreement on holding the elections. That implies he will remain in office until the parties can agree on a way to choose his successor. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
For analysis of the constitutional crisis in Somalia, we are joined by Abdi Razak Omar Mohamed, a Somali Member of Parliament and former Security Minister.
Right now we are in a constitutional crisis because the term of the president ended today. He has run the country for about 4 years, and as stipulated by the constitution, at the end of the 4 years, he no longer has the legitimacy to hold the country. That is what happened today. The president has failed to reconcile with the political actors and stakeholders to come up with an election process that is fair and transparent, that is acceptable to everyone, There has been many meetings and conferences that were convened and facilitated by the international partners. He has failed to reconcile. So that is where we are in the eyes of everybody, that he's no longer the president. He might be still in the villa, Somalia, but no one is recognizing him as the legitimate president of this country.
So what about the information we are getting about alliance of opposition parties proposing to form a group that will govern the country? Who is going to run the country if the president term has expired?
Well, there will be consultations. Broad consultations that will be held within the next couple of days, I believe, where the civil society will be part of that. Regional head of states will be part of that. Presidential contenders will be part of that. And what they are trying to do is to chart a way out of the stalemate that we are in right now. I think what we don't want to see is that the country reverting back to the old days. We want it to move forward. I think it's the right thing that the opposition alliances are doing to convene a meeting to discuss issues of national interest. Since there's a vacuum now, there's no presidency that has the legitimacy to convene a conference. That leaves them to take those steps to call for a national conference to be convened as soon as possible.
Is the president trying to negotiate to at least extend his term in office? What is he doing?
Well, there was a time that he had a leverage to lead the discussions, but now he no longer has that leverage. If he prefers, he can participate in those conferences. As a former president, he can participate in those conferences and be part of the solution, but he doesn't have. And nobody is now acknowledging him as someone who can get solutions to the stalemate that we are in, because he's the one who was responsible in the first place.
That was Abdi Razak Umar Mohamed, a Somali member of parliament and former defense minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mogadishu. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 9th. The Liberian Supreme Court on Monday upheld a lower court guilty verdict against former Defense Minister Brownie Samukai and two other co-defendants. Mr. Samukai, Liberia's longest-serving defense minister, was found guilty last year along with two others for allegedly using pension funds belonging to the Armed Forces of Liberia. A lower court had ordered them to make restitution of U.S. $1.4 million. Joining us from Monrovia is Rodney Sear, the editor-in-chief and publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper.
Well, James, the Supreme Court ruling Monday afternoon was very shocking to a lot of people. Mr. Brownie Samukai, the former defense minister who ran on the ticket of the collaborating political parties, won his seat emphatically for the vote-rich Lofa County back in December. And he won an overwhelming showing of support amongst his constituents. And so there were a few concerns regarding a lower court verdict prior to that election that said he was guilty and should restitute some money from the previous Ellen Johnson Sirleaf government. And so the Supreme Court upheld the lower court ruling on Monday, meaning that they've pretty much thrown the election of Mr. Samukai into a constitutional crisis.
The allegation, Rodney, is that the former defense minister and his co-defendants misused public funds for their personal benefits. Briefly, can you tell us the history of this allegation?
Well, prior to this incumbent George Weah-led government, there were some issues regarding the expenditure of Ministry of Defense funding. During the trial, former President Sirleaf communicated to the court that some of the funds that were in question were approved or authorized by her office. And so a lot of concern that Mr. Samukai is being, if I may say, maybe targeted by the ruling party, because the lower court ruling was very controversial. It wasn't a clear-cut ruling. And so the Supreme Court ruling Monday kind of like threw everything in a disarray, because there are a lot of concern that the ruling may have been pressured by the ruling party to prevent an opposition candidate from serving in the Senate.
What do you think this verdict will mean in terms of his political career? Can this preclude him from serving as a senator?
Well, currently, James, there is no law on the books keeping an elected official. The question is, with the Supreme Court upholding the lower court verdict that the minister must restitute the amount in question, yes, $1.4 million, or serve 2 years in prison, is very, very controversial and suggests that there will be or there may be some complications in terms of how it was carried out, because a lot of people are concerned that this is being politicized, considering the overwhelming victory of Mr. Samukai. So people are just looking to see how the government intends to carry out this verdict by the Supreme Court.
What do you think are his options now, Rodney? After all, this ruling came from the Supreme Court of Liberia. Can he pursue other legal avenues outside of Liberia? Some are suggesting perhaps the ECOWAS Court of Justice.
That may be an option, but at the same time, the Supreme Court is also expected to hear an appeal from the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change, which filed a motion after Mr. Samukai was declared victorious by the National Elections Commission last week. So this is like a very complicated saga involving the minister, because there are two different things happening. The issue with his victory and the issue of these charges emanating from the former government of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So the verdict has the propensity to dampen the enthusiasm that has engulfed this Samukai's victory for a sitting senator and diminish his spirit of serving the people of Lofa County. He's the longest serving defense minister in this country. He was one of those who was the engineer behind the training of the armed forces of Liberia after Ellen Johnson came to office. And so it's just a matter of time to see how this all plays out. He has a lot of options on the table. He can pursue the ECOWAS court. He can go ahead and take his seat because he's been certificated by the Election Commission, although the ruling party has also filed the appeal in that case. So it's a very, very difficult thing for the minister. It depends on how the George Weah government intends to implement this verdict to the fullest to keep the minister from serving the Senate.
Rodney, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Thank you, James.
That was Rodney Sie, editor-in-chief and publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper, speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, conditions in Guinean prisons are not up to international standards and need to be improved, according to Amnesty International. Amnesty International researcher Fabian Offner tells Reiki Shryak that there is only one doctor for every 2,000 detainees in Conakry's overcrowded prison, and conditions there are inhumane.
During a health crisis like the COVID-19 pandemic we are experiencing right now, it's even more important to be able to provide healthcare to detainees and prisoners in Guinea. And the specificity of this country, which is not the only country which is concerned by this problem, of course, is the overpopulation of the prisons, of the center of detention. And when you have these two phenomena combined, like a COVID-19 pandemic and overpopulated prisons, of course, the risk is even more important because you already have some specific disease in the prisons. And if you add to this the COVID-19 pandemic, we can imagine what could be the health situation. And in the last month, the Guinean authorities have taken some initiative regarding the COVID-19 pandemic. Some detainees were tested in the Kenya prison, in the main Conakry prisons, notably, and they found some cases.
Besides the shortage of doctors in the Conakry prison, what are other conditions that violate international law or violate a prisoner's right to be treated with dignity?
First, you have the issue of detainees who were brought to jail and who already have some health issues. And some of them were not provided enough health care regarding their issue. We know that some people were arrested while being hospitalized, or were arrested with, for example, diabetes, and were not given all the health care that they need to. We see today with Umar Sylla, for example, that he has serious health problem, and he has been brought outside the prison in a health structure, which should be the normality, but this has not been the normality in the last weeks and in the last month.
Can you tell me about some of the health issues and the health problems that detainees have experienced in recent weeks, according to the detainees' lawyers?
Detainees who are in a good health care and who are brought to prison And inside this prison, they got sick because of the lack of food, of the lack of good food, of the lack of vitamins, the fact that the cells are overpopulated, and you can have people sleeping on each other because they lack space. You don't have proper sanitation when you go, typically, to say, like, it's when you go to the toilet, for example, you don't have enough toilets for all the detainees. People are defecating or urinating close to each other. So, of course, it brings a lot of disease. And the fact is that regarding the information we had, you don't have any medical for all these detainees, which are close to 2,000. And the information we had is that you only have one médecin, one medical who is there most of the time.
That was Fabian Ofner, a researcher at Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. Guinea's government has denied what it calls erroneous Amnesty International report on bad prison conditions in Guinea. The Ministry of Justice says the February 3rd report lacks objectivity. It accuses Amnesty International of partisan and subjective spirit on human rights issues concerning Guinea. The government says Guinea is signatory to international human rights protocols and adheres to standards on prison conditions. The government also says it respects the rights of detainees in the areas of health, food, hygiene, and physical and moral integrity. It also says prisoners are given legal services. Burkina Faso has good practices for regulations on artisanal firearms, practices that could be looked at as examples for other countries in the region, says Leonardo Lara, a crime prevention and criminal justice officer at the UNODC. Lara spoke to Ricky Stryak about some of the pros and cons of Burkina Faso's artisanal firearm rules.
There have indeed been some positive steps in terms of regulations by the authorities from Burkina Faso to control this production of artisanal weapons. Some of these measures that they have taken include, for example, the fact that they have a registry of producers, so they know who is allowed by the government to produce these artisanal weapons. And something also very interesting is that they introduce the marking of these. Of these artisanal weapons. So, you know, you have a local producer who does, some manual work to produce an artisanal weapon, and he will actually produce a marking, and this mark is registered, so that can serve if the arm gets diverted and it's used in a crime. It's just an example. You could identify who produced that weapon, and then if you identify who produced it, you could eventually get to whom it was sold.
Are those markings kind of what would be the equivalent of serial numbers sometimes?
That is a good question, and this is why this is why I speak of good practices. There are things that need to improve. I remember, I was there, I think, last year when we were allowed to travel, and I visited one of the one of these local producers, and to answer your question, no, it's not a serial number. So, of course, that would definitely add a measure of security. It's just a mark from the producer that tells you it was kind of like a signature. You know, it lets you know that it was done by this producer. But no, it's, according to the best of my knowledge, it's not so, evolved as to have a serial number.
What are some of the challenges of implementing these regulations in Burkina Faso?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely a lot to do. And you know, we mentioned the case of Burkina Faso because if you look at the production of artisanal weapons in West Africa, it is very widespread. You have it a lot, for traditional reasons, for hunting purposes. So there are definitely legitimate reasons why people produce and sell these weapons.
That was Leonardo Lara, a crime prevention and criminal justice officer. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Vienna. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.